Okay, we'll open the public hearing on Joint Committee on Ways and Means, General Government Subcommittee. We're hearing public hearing Senate Bill 5532, Construction Contractors Board and Landscape Contractors Board. We'll let the record show that those not present are excused. Welcome, Representative Jackson.
Chair Hayden, members of the committee, my name is Ken Kudel. I'm the Administrator of Construction Contractors Board. I think where we left off was on page 12 of my presentation with performance measure. And Senator Dukes had a number of questions, had a little bit of discussion with her before the meeting was over. So I prepared some further explanation of these and Robert, do they have that copy of the handout that I just gave you?
Oh, yes, they do.
Yes, okay. The last page of that is really the what I've tried to explain in the five pages before that is how we arrived at some of these numbers. Prior to 2001, we were dealing with what we classed shown on here as the old measures. These are something very similar to these measures since about 1989. And in discussions with our budget analyst, with the fiscal officer, and with others, the discussion that these really weren't measuring whether we're accomplishing or meeting our goals. So we believe we're going to keep much of this, but we've added the top five as additional measures. And each of those measures one or more of our six goals. What I've attempted to show here in the attachment, and I won't go into great detail on that other than if somebody has questions now or at a later time, I'll try to get into that. You know, one I would like to talk to, though, is goal number two. Or performance measure number two, because in this case, we want to increase the percentage of people who understand their rights and responsibilities and the rights of the consumer, the contractor, and the role and the authority of CCB. And we had a benchmark there of 20% because in 1995 we had a performance audit that basically said only about 20% of people even know that CCB exists. Establish a goal of 60%, unfortunately, what we chose to survey, we surveyed some people and came up with 80%. But that's asking people after the fact, did you know about us? Did you know about your responsibility before you got into the system? And people have a different memory of that. Senator Dukes suggested that we go with maybe measure some people who are filing for permits. And that would get somebody that's maybe never had any experience with us. And do they know? And so we need a different audience to make that measurement. The number four is also an area where we had some good experience this past year, decreasing the number of owner claims not paid in full. We look at this to we got a benchmark of 305 and. Goal would be to reduce that to 150. Well, in 99-2000, we ended up with 198. Now, why is that? We'd like to say it's because our education program and all other things have done so much good, but we don't know. We hope that that's going to be a more permanent thing. And number five, that's an area where, Representative, you and others get more complaints about the CCB than probably anything else. We resolve disputes, even if the parties signed a settlement agreement, they may not be 100% happy with it, may not think the system is fair and equitable. So trying to do a better job of communicating on that one and measuring how are we doing. Right now, about 60% of the people seem to think that it's fair and equitable. And we'd shoot for 75%. We'll never get 100% on that one either. So unless somebody has questions on the rest of this, I won't spend any more time on performance.
Well, just that I appreciate the predicament you find yourself in, but I notice in the legislature that we often adjust our laws and our administrative rules to suit the practice of the people. which when you think about it, makes a lot of sense. I think President Eisenhower, or someone once complained to President Eisenhower when he was a university president, that the students weren't walking on the sidewalk, they were walking across the grass, and his response was, "But the sidewalk where they're walking." So we often do that, and we often adjust our benchmark goals to fit what reality is. I mean, we can set the goals, but if we don't hit the target, then it's easier to adjust the goals than it is to adjust the practices of the people. So I can appreciate what you find yourself with here, where you're overperforming in one category and underperforming in another one. You will find out what's possible and what reality is in due course. And that's all the questions I have. Does the administrator have a comment? Okay.
Earlier we had discussion of I guess I'm now on page 13, factors affecting service. And
page what?
Page 13. I'm at the top of page 13, and this agency is highly reliant on the computer. If it slows down or if it's down, we lose a great amount of efficiency. Construction industry is impacted greatly by any downturn in the economy, and at the present time, a strong economy the past several years, low unemployment rates, leads to shortage of experienced construction workers. I don't think it's a surprise to too many people that working in construction isn't the number one on the list of what people want to do with their life, particularly in the areas of insulation or roofing or that sort of thing. Interagency and intergovernmental programs, we operate through an interagency agreement, the Landscape Contractors Board program. We investigate unlicensed plumbing and electrical activity through an interagency agreement with the Building Codes Division. And we have an interagency agreement with the Department of Justice and Oregon State Police regarding illegal activity or construction fraud. Revenue, we've had some discussion of this. 96% of the revenue of the board is from license and license renewal fees. The rates were adjusted in 1997. We also now are on a two-year license renewal, so you can see here that the first year of licensing, some of these people are paying a little over $200 for a two-year time period. We retain 20% of the civil penalty money collected to help offset the cost of that collection. The balance of that goes to the general fund. And then we receive interagency payments from both the Landscape Contractors Board and the Building Codes Division. So it's a pretty simple budget as far as revenue is concerned. Historical expenditures, I didn't list those. I think LFO has done a pretty decent job of showing where we are and where we've been. Program growth, we're estimating no growth or reduction in licensing or claim numbers. The primary factor driving program costs appears to be number of licensed contractors, and of course the economy creates that, so you got more licensed contractors, generally that means more claims also. Claim growth has parallel licensing almost from the get-go, about 1 to 10. Comparison with licensing cost in other states, the state of Washington is considerably less than Oregon. California, Arizona, and Nevada are considerably more. Interestingly, looking at nationwide, other than the western states, most of the licensing boards don't get much involved in regulating residential contractors. Most of them are involved with regulating commercial contractors. It's more health and safety as opposed to protecting the consumer from a standpoint of financial protection.
Are the residential contractors just local planning commissions or nothing? What is it?
about half the states have a, some kind of licensing, but what, even when they do, they'll have a for instance, one of the states has, if the contract is for less than $25,000, you don't have to be a licensed contractor. Well, that's where most of the problems occur in this state, particularly if you got roofing and painting and those kinds of things. Arizona and California and Nevada are probably some of the toughest areas. They extensive licensing requirements from the standpoint of technical competence. Oregon, our licensing has to do with do you know how to be a business person and do you know the laws and rules you have to comply with. About it. Essential packages, again, I don't know that we need to discuss that anymore. I think that's been discussed. Budget reductions, one of the essential packages would be a budget reduction of $104,000. And then we did present the House Bill 3182 reduction option, which thank goodness wasn't accepted by the governor. And then into the enhancement programs, again, that's pretty much been covered. The first package is adjusted down to the point of this would be a an enforcement manager, one FTE enforcement manager. Purchase package number 101, purchase and replace some workstations and an adjustment in square foot correction in our rent. Contract manuals is 102 and this is one that we've also had considerable discussion on that already.
I've lost track. Where are you now?
I'm at the bottom of page 15.
Okay.
Okay. Jim Johnson, I think, again, what I, it's something I handed out at the first.
You handed that out today?
No, I handed it out the first day.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then I've got my book. Sorry. Sorry. Thank you.
I guess I go back to the, I hope that you, of all of the packages that we have, in my mind, the most important one is the 100. This deputy administrator since 1990, we've been short one manager. We had a full-time deputy prior to that, and we've not had one since. And since I'm leaving the agency in June, it's easy for me to say to you and to say that the new administrator needs a full-time deputy. Otherwise, enforcement suffers. And the agency's management suffers, and so I hope that's not a package that you have questions about.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. How big is this shop again? Remind me.
64 points.
Thank you.
And your administrative span of control is 1 to 8, 1 to 7?
Yes. I think that's what it is.
Or is it 1 to 8?
1 to 8. We've had discussion of the package. I'm on page 16 now, 104, the consumer protection package. I don't know that we need to discuss that any further. And then 105, which was kind of a late addition, reclassification of a position. Reason for this reclassification coming in late is that we after completing the business plan, concluded that our website was going to be more important to us. As it's turned out, it has been. Our website, we've needed more of a person's time managing that website. And so that's what this
Mr.
is.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are you relying on the Department of Administrative Services at all? We have, at this committee, guided a number of folks into the burgeoning shop that DAS is operating for information technology. What relationship do you have with them?
Aiden, Representative Johnson, we have they host our website, meaning that from the standpoint of worrying about the site itself, but it's putting the information out there is what, because it's all related to this agency, and because we have an active, live information regarding consumer contractor licensing and other information. So I think this is the way most of the agencies do. They're hosted by DAS, but they have their own administrator.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear from committee staff, and then I have another question.
Let me clarify, make sure I understand the question you were asking. Were you asking about whether or not DAS Human Resources Division had looked at the classification, or whether DAS IRMD had looked at the website?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, the answer to your question is yes to one and partially yes to the other. The Department of Administrative Services, I don't know if you recall the testimony the first day, has been very involved in working with the department to develop its technology plan, to develop its information technology strategy, and so there is significant DAS oversight of what they are doing with their technology, and they will be reporting on that in full this afternoon in front of the Advancing E-Government Committee. With regard to the classification issue, the department had a complete review of its classification system in the fall of 1999. This reclass was subsequent to that and was a paper review only. That is, they looked at what was put down on paper in terms of whether or not the descriptions fit the proposed classification. I think it's going to be LFO's recommendation that a more thorough review be done before that classification is approved.
Okay, thank you.
I think that brings us through the packages, the budget notes we talked of. There were, I believe, five budget notes, and we complied with all five of those at this point. And that pretty much takes me to the end of the presentation on the construction contractors board.
One more question. The book that we were discussing last week, the contractors book that you all send out, how much of that information could actually go on your website?
Chair Hayden, Rep. St. Johnson, I had some discussion with our computer people yesterday about that. Is at some point the whole thing needs to go on the website and be available. At this point, our contract with Experior ends, I believe, in November of 2002.
Remind me, that's the print house of the
yes.
guys that do this thing?
Yes, and what we did with this on printing the book is we don't pay them anything. They make their money by selling that book to contractors.
Members of the committee, I'm pretty sure the committee doesn't understand the relationship that you have. That book does not belong to the Construction Contractors Board. It is copyrighted by Experior, the company that is producing it. And there is an arrangement between the board and that company to produce additional manuals for the grandfathered folks. The ones that are going through the training buy it as part of the training and pay Experior directly.
In case I had any latent bad feelings about that book, they have blossomed into absolutely antagonistic feelings about that book. You have a contract so that we don't own that? The state of Oregon doesn't own that?
Chair Hayden, Rep. St. Johnson, we wanted to own it, but our attorney said that he couldn't own it.
Your attorneys would be the Department of Justice. Why?
Copyright laws, it's beyond me. I couldn't fully understand it other than that's what we ended up with is we wanted a outright ownership or joint ownership, and when we got through with it, this is what we got. And now, when it's all through and could be updated in November of 2002, and the board could own it at that point and go into the publishing business, I guess, if they would choose to do that. At this point, though, up until this point, and separate this from the sending the book for grandfathering. What we were looking for is a way of having a good textbook for the new contractors coming on, and that's still the primary purpose of that book, is for a new contractor coming on. They have that book, they study that book, and they can pass the exam.
I'm just astonished. How large is the contract?
Contract, we don't pay them anything.
But they own all of the intellectual material in that book?
Yes, ma'am.
And you are bound to use them to produce that book until 2002?
There are maybe some escape clauses in there, but I for cause, whatever it might be. But if we don't use that book, then we'd have to have another book. So
we require folks that are going to take the contractor's exam to use that book. And the state of Oregon doesn't own any part of the intellectual property in the book. Is that typical?
I do not know. It actually, to the best of my knowledge, I don't know of any other arrangement quite like that, but my knowledge is limited.
Well, I think you might compare it to all the continuing education requirements that we require of CPAs and lawyers and dentists, and you have to take continuing education. You have to buy a lot of textbooks that aren't owned by the board. They're owned by proprietary companies, but you must still buy them and study them in order for your continuing education. This is basically continuing education. It's a test to see if you can. So, yeah, I see a great similarity there.
One more question. How large is your pool of grandfathered folks proportionally to the non-grandfathered ones?
For Hayden, Rep. Johnson, in a typical year prior to the exam, we would license about 6,000 new contractors. With the exam, that number has gone down. The retainage, the dropout of contractors, has also gone down. But in answer to your question, about 45,000 at the time that the testing went into effect, where there were about 45,000 licensed contractors.
Who are now considered grandfathered?
Yes.
As opposed to 6,000 new ones in the pipeline every year?
Yes.
Or less.
Probably closer to 4,000 in the pipeline every year than 6. The number each month has gone up. We had Madhouse in June before July, because there was anybody who came in and licensed in June, May and June of 2000, didn't have to take the test. And so we didn't get many new licensees in July, August, September, and October, because they'd all come in earlier and got licensed, so they didn't have to take the test.
So that was a calendar problem, not an exemption problem. When you say that they came in May and June, I'm not sure I understand.
Well, if they came in and completed their licensing before July 1, then they didn't have to take the test.
And they would be then considered part of this grandfathered pool.
That's just the way the legislation was structured. This was not our legislation.
Whose legislation was it?
It was home builders legislation. The desire was just to begin the process of making contractors responsible and knowledgeable about being in business. And again, if we had to do over again, I suppose we would have had something where we didn't have that. You can sneak in May and June, but history is that's what has happened. We had a couple of thousand people who came in those last 2 months.
And that door is now closed?
It's closed.
Okay.
Do you have an overview of the Landscape Contractors Board?
I do have.
Yeah. get into by accident.
Presentation, checking, now I have my other hat on, so I'm the administrator of the Landscape Contractors Board. Presentation here is considerably shorter, and I'm going to try to make it even shorter than that by explaining that in 1971, legislature created a number of licensing or registration boards. And one of them was the Old Builders Board, and the other was the Landscape Contractors Board. Landscape Contractors Board was an advisory board until 1987, when the Department of Commerce was disbanded. And in 1987, the Landscape Contractors Board was made a policy board, and the governor's recommendation was that the Builders Board and the Landscape Contractors Board be administered by the same staff. There's a fair amount of similarity between the two boards. The one area of difference is that with landscape contractors, that's the individual. In every landscaping business, there is some individual who is an employee or an owner who has passed a pretty extensive series of tests on landscaping, soils, drainage, plant identification, fertilization, irrigation, backflow prevention, all of those things. It isn't like electrical or plumbing in that in electrical and plumbing fields, nobody can do electrical work unless they have a license. In landscape, you just have to have somebody who supervises the work of those who are doing the landscaping work. So they've had testing through all those years, and many people would say, why testing there, why not in construction? My answer for that, the best answer I've been able to develop for myself, is that in construction, most of the things you do in construction have something to do with code. So you have to meet a certain code so you know when something is good or when it isn't good, at least the minimum of the code. In landscaping, even the irrigation system doesn't have to be code. There is no code for an irrigation system. It would be for the backflow prevention. But what kind of a code would you have for preparation of the soil and selection of plants and planting of the plants? There is no code. So we rely upon the licensing to say that the people who are doing this are competent. 7-member board. Again, it's a 5 members of the board.
Let me come back to that just a moment. Over the weekend, I read the newsletter of the Landscape Contractors Board, and I read the penalties that they had assessed recently. And I don't recall that any of the penalties were for noncompliance or dereliction of duty or incompetence. They were all $1,000 or $2,000 fines. Most of them were $1,000 or $2,000 fines for simply not being registered. There didn't seem to be any indication that the consumer was dissatisfied or that there was any fraud or non-performance. It's just that they weren't licensed. And I was curious about that. If the main function, which is goal number one, on the hand to ensure that all those who are performing landscape contracting activities are properly licensed, it would seem the goal would be to ensure, if there is to be a board at all, to ensure that the consumer gets value for their money.
Sure, that does occur, but it occurs through the claims program, which is similar to the claims program that Construction Contractors Board has. Landscape Contractors Board can accept and process claims for negligent and improper work and breach of contract. And so those issues of somebody performing not up to standard would be handled through the claim system.
And where is that cutoff point for the requirement for licensure? Let me phrase my question in a context that I'm pretty familiar with. I had a fellow working in my yard. And the scope of what he was doing continued to increase until finally he was planting a bunch of trees for me. And I just considered it yard maintenance right up until we planted all of these trees. All of the trees died. What's the threshold point for when he needs to be registered you know, versus a kid dragging around a lawnmower and somebody holding themselves out able to do planting and much more significant improvements.
Sure, Hayden. Sam Johnson, the threshold in this case is when the job exceeds $500. When the landscaping work part of the job and planting of the trees is landscape contracting work, taking care of the trees is not. But the planting of the trees and shrubs and irrigation systems and all of that is landscape contracting work. And so when the amount of that got to the $500 point, then that person is in violation unless they are a licensed landscape contractor.
I'm still trying to understand it. If I decide that I'm going to open a yard maintenance operation, and I have 10 customers, and I'm dragging my equipment around in a trailer behind my vehicle, and I'm doing yard maintenance for them, and planting, and mowing of grass, and things, am I then subject to this?
Chair Hayden, Representative Johnson, if you do more than $500 of the planting of other than annuals, then you are subject to this. If you hold yourself out to be a landscape contractor, so you would have to advertise landscape maintenance. You couldn't advertise, actually, if you put in your advertisement that you're doing planting, you would then be in violation.
Where's the enforcement level? Because it sounds to me that you've set up a scenario by which I could say, the planting was totally incidental to what I'm doing. I'm really in the grass mowing business.
Sir Hayden, Representative Johnson, the board feels strongly about this the same way. They've just never been able to gather where you would draw the line further on this one, and their only answer to that is more enforcement and more information to the public so that when they hire somebody, even for maintenance, they aren't assured that they're getting anybody that has any degree of knowledge. If you hire a landscape contractor who also does maintenance, most of them do, then at least you're hiring someone who has on staff or as an owner demonstrated that they have knowledge of fertilizers and soils and drainage and irrigation.
So the requirement is at labor that exceeds $500 in terms of planting, then there's a requirement to be licensed.
Yes.
Huh. Okay.
But existing lawns or shrubs, trimming the hedges, pruning the trees?
It's major pruning. Some years ago, tree service became one where consumers were harmed by that. So major taking care of trees. And when we're talking of this, we'd say taking down a tree that's over 3 inches in diameter at the base, or taking limbs off that are 3 inches in diameter, actually taking guying that tree. Those are things that either you have to be a licensed landscaping business or you have to be a licensed construction contractor. It's not so much that you could do the work wrong, but you can cause a lot of damage, and that's what it's intended for, is to protect them. So they can go either way for tree maintenance. Can be either a construction contractor or a licensed landscaping business. And that also is one where at some point, probably tree service, when landscape goes off and is on its own, semi-independent, I think in the future you'll see a piece of legislation that would say we ought to move most of that tree service over to landscape, which is where it belongs. There may be as many as 800 tree service people licensed by the Construction Contractors Board. That their primary purpose is that trees tend to grow a lot in this country and get some winds, and so after each one of those, there's an awful lot of tree service work that has to be done, and it is one where consumers need some protection from the damage that they could cause if they don't have insurance, if they don't have the bond. Again, 7-member board, 5 of those are from the industry. The only difference with this board is that at the present time, it has never been into the confirmed by the Senate. These are people that are appointed by the governor, and as soon as the governor appoints them, they become board members. They don't have to go through the Senate confirmation. have similar programs all the way through: consumer education, dispute resolution, damage recovery, law enforcement. In this case, a sizable number lower than in construction. Typical year, 75 or 57 civil penalties at the 75 warnings.
Do you use your own internal mediation services for this program, or do you contract with the Dispute Resolution Commission folks?
Chair Hayden, Representative Johnson, our claim staff has people who handle the paper in the office. Claims examiner would be the title of that individual. So the negotiation, if it's by correspondence, would be by those people. We have five employees who do inspection and mediation. They go out to the site and try to meet with the parties. And those are people, we've had that position, not as many, but we've had that position since almost the beginning, since 1971. Someone who can go out on site, be a third party. It's more of a third party intervention than it is mediation, because we go out and look at, see what the problem is, and if we can get both parties there, we generally get a settlement, 70% plus. If it has to go to a hearing, it goes before the hearings officer panel, before one of those hearings people.
And you guys use the central hearings panel?
Yes, we do.
How satisfactory with the paucity of claims that you have, how satisfactorily is that working out for you to be part of that central hearings panel?
The end result has not been much different. It's cost us a little bit more. It's taken us a bit of time to get there on administrative rules. I guess our biggest problem would be on the administrative rules and the problem of we're dealing with two-party issues, and most people thinking of administrative hearings are thinking of one-party hearings where somebody's taking action against a contractor. We're talking about trying to settle an issue. But all in all, the Construction Contractors Group was greatly opposed to this, and we worked very closely with them to make it work, and at this point it is working. The Landscape Contractors Board doesn't have the same detailed kind of business plan. However, I've shared the CCB business plan with them, and they're in the process of looking at creating one. Landscape Contractors Board is having a strategy setting session instead of their a June meeting to talk more about that very issue. Major program changes here. I covered most of those. I'm now on page 3 of this presentation. And, the major things happened in 1987 when they became independent. 1987 when they became an independent agency in 87, and that's the same year that they entered into an interagency agreement with the Construction Contractors Board. In 87, they were authorized to install backflow prevention devices. This is one of the few cases where somebody with this license is allowed to do a very restrictive amount of plumbing, install that backflow device for that irrigation system. You have to get a permit, have to meet all those conditions, but they're authorized to do that plumbing. In 1991, they became authorized to install low-voltage lighting. And again, this is also one low voltage wiring, actually, because the controls of an irrigation system are the lighting for a landscape project, and they're required to get a permit there. Again, they're authorized to do some electrical work, but they have to get the permit. They were impacted some by the hearing staff moving over, but again, their hearings are relatively the same as the CCB's. Efficiency, coordination, and administrative cost, steps taken to control costs. The biggest area for both of these boards to control cost is increased emphasis on self-service. If people can help themselves, if you've got information and people know about it, can they get that information themselves rather than coming in by telephone? They use contract investigators for enforcement investigations instead of full-time employees. Again, they share in the cost of these 12 investigators scattered around the state who do investigations, enforcement investigations on a contract basis. They have an interagency agreement with the Department of Agriculture. With that interagency agreement, last legislative session, they were able to keep away from having to become a licensed nursery. That's worked very well. And revenue, employment, support service, student loans. Again, Landscape Contractors Board would suspend the license if an individual was out of compliance with any of those. We're going through the activities included in administrative costs, the same here that it was with the Construction Contractors Board.
Are these one of these deadbeat dad?
Yes.
Is that what that is?
Yes, it is. And there's a fair amount of that that's there. Those systems are not creating a tremendously big load on us, but they've added in the recent years the student loan. And then also because of the eight conditions of being an independent contractor, we work very closely with revenue and employment and workers' comp on that issue, and we share information, because generally they're playing games on the independent contractor thing with one of us, they're playing it with all four of us.
All four of you, excuse me, what constitutes all four?
I can quote the right one. ORS 670.500, I think, is where there are eight conditions of being an independent contractor. And it says that revenue, employment, workers' comp, and CCB, and maybe Secretary of State, would all adopt and operate by those same eight conditions.
Oh, I'm with you. So if they're fooling the Construction Contractors Board, they're probably trying to fool.
Yes.
I'm with you now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And again, they share about 3.5%. We have been on a tracking our time spent for almost a dozen years now, I guess, maybe more than that, where at the end of the day, we try to track where our time was spent to the nearest hour. We're not into this like attorneys would do or maybe dentists would do, where you're in a shorter time period than that. So we know how much time that staff spends on landscape contractors, and it's been about 3.5%. So all of those things that would be true for construction are true. If they share in the same computer system, again, share a cost of operating that computer system. All of the things that we've covered to you with you before, makeup of the system, monitoring and reviewing of contract service delivered online. Budget-related legislation, it's House Bill 2127. This board believes, and there's obviously some truth to that, this board believes that they're dominated by the Construction Contractors Board. They are a separate policy board. There's an interagency agreement that is between the Landscape Contractors Board, the Construction Contractors Board, and the administrator, the three people who signed that agreement. But when you've only paid 3.5% of the cost and you've got an enforcement program out there, then it's hard for it to twist in the direction that they might want it to go. More detail, again, I think it's a repeat on page 6 of my report. Our customers, same customers, basic customers that you have in construction. Oftentimes, a landscape contractor and will be just one of the subs on a project, a larger project. We deliver services, licensing and renewal, again, all of the same, by mail, by fax. We accept credit card payments. A little less here, but I think it's still pretty close to 8% of our revenue comes in through credit card payments. That's been a real good tool for us. Consumer education, we always have landscape material with construction for home shows. Number of calls per day are considerably less than. But they have, they're also parent everything on the website, on the IVR. Dispute resolution, instead of 400 claims a month, here we have 70 claims a year for landscape, so considerably smaller operation. factors affecting service. I'm just repeating it, virtually everything I had before until you get over on revenue on page 9. And in this case, a greater percentage of the income is from contractor licensing and renewal fees. The fee was last increased here in 1997. The current fee schedule is given here. It's not a terribly large fee. They are very close to needing a fee increase at the present time. They do not have much of a reserve. They also get to retain 20% of the civil penalty money collected. And we're estimating no growth here. What has happened here, we think, is that businesses have gotten bigger, but no more businesses. So we don't have the growth that would have paralleled the growth that's occurred in the construction industry. The growth here has been 2, 3, 5% at most, and in some years just plain flat, nothing. So some businesses have gotten larger for landscaping purposes and more rounded businesses that used to be businesses that did landscaping or did irrigation only, and now you have more companies out there that do maintenance, they do landscape contracting for new construction, they do irrigation systems, they do repair, they do all of it. Some very large businesses now. So we're at about 950 businesses and about 1,200 individuals licensed at the present time. Have one essential package, and that would be adjusted out if 2127 passes. And do you have questions?
I believe that concludes the hearing that we were going to have today, finishing up the walkthrough of the construction contractors board and the landscape contractors board, unless the committee has other questions.
No. It's a public hearing. Does anyone in the room have anything to say? Is there any reason why we should not adjourn forthwith? So let it be done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.